Gotta be a day. You've been acting lazy. Make me wanna stay. That would be amazing. I don't know if I even gotta say this, but I think that we could be the greatest.
We'll be right back. brother man. You gotta keep on stepping, 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 brother man.
DJ,
this is URN
University
Radio,
Nottingham.
Hello and welcome to The Pulse. This is URN's daily news show, bringing the news that matters to you every weekday between 5 and 6. I'm Ben, and joining me today, we've got Rebecca and Elliot. So, coming up, the Home Secretary Priti Patel has been accused of bullying in a third government department. These claims come from her time as International Development Secretary between 2016 and 2017. Researchers have found that there is a striking overlap between places in England with slow public transport and places with struggling secondary schools. The research compared travel time data and education results. In the US, Joe Biden has cemented his comeback in the Democratic Party's presidential primaries. He won 9 of the 14 states which voted yesterday on Super Tuesday to pick who they want to go up against Donald Trump in the November election. And a 23-year-old woman is taking legal action against an NHS gender clinic, saying she should have been challenged more by medical staff over her decision to transition to male as a teenager. So that's all coming up, and if you want to say anything about what we're discussing, you can find us on Twitter at URNPulse, and also go to our website, urn1350.net, and send us a message from there. So, first of all, this evening, we're going to be starting off with the new allegations of bullying against Home Secretary Priti Patel. And Priti Patel has now been accused of bullying at a third government department, and this is according to the BBC. The claims are from her time as International Development Secretary from 2016 to 2017 and follow similar claims at the Home Office and the Department for Work and Pensions. A Conservative source said dark forces were trying to influence an inquiry into Ms. Patel's conduct in her current role. She also denies all of the allegations. The latest claims reportedly brought to a senior official at the Department for International Development after she quit as its Secretary of State in 2017. The BBC reported on Monday that an official in the Department for Work and Pensions received a £25,000 payoff after alleged that she was bullied by Ms. Patel in 2015 during her time at that department. So the DWP did not admit liability and the case did not go to a tribunal. So the allegations were described as similar to those levelled against Ms. Patel by Sir Philip Rutman, who resigned as the Home Office Permanent Secretary on Saturday. The latest claims come to light were reported passed in 2017 to the DFID official by another senior figure in the department who advised that the Cabinet Secretary at the time, the Lord Hayward, should be informed. Ms. Patel resigned as Secretary of State for International Development in November 2017 over an unauthorised visit to Israel. And the Home Office has said that the Home Secretary categorically rejects all these allegations, and today the Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, has given his backing to the Home Secretary. So this has all kind of been building up now. So what do we think about the situation that we're in at the minute, and whether or not these claims were always going to come out?
Well, I think the important part is to take note of the fact that it's they're allegations. They're alleged claims for bullying. And so I think we have to be careful when making pure accusations now based on an allegation until a formal inquiry has been put in. And I think reading a related article, I think Boris Johnson said that he was happy to look into allegations because he does not enjoy bullying. However, he does not believe, of course, that Ms. Patel is actually guilty of any of these claims. And it's just, in a way, it is kind of ironic. A lot of the people who are calling for inquiries into Priti Patel bullying claims are people high up in the Labour Party, which recently was the head of one of the largest anti-Semitism scandals in the Western world in recent years. There's a bit of give and take there. Looking into it, I think this is really making a bit of a scaremongering, mountain out of a molehill. Definitely, bullying is something that needs to be taken seriously, especially when you're on the face of politics, right? And you've got people bullying other people into doing what they want in a case where you're trying to represent your country and make matters that will affect the nation. it's important, but then again, she is the Home Secretary, and it's a tough job, right? She is basically having to crack down on a lot of the of really difficult topics such as immigration and crime, and it's. So some people are naturally going to feel bullied in when it comes to that sort of thing. I think any Home Secretary that's ever lived that's done a decent job will have met claims of this sort. Maybe not to this extent, which is kind of the worrying thing, isn't it? But again, I can only really stick behind waiting to see what will come out of it, out of an allegation. If an independent inquiry comes in and says, yes, there's evidence of this, then we've got a problem. But until that comes out, then I guess we just have to wait and see.
I mean, I wouldn't necessarily say that, like, the difficulty of the job, like, inevitably means that bullying will become a part of it. I don't know whether that, like, I think maybe testament to the quality of the person doing the job, like, the kind of quality that they're delivering the job on, should, whether there's bullying there, should kind of indicate that maybe they aren't up to the job, rather than necessarily that it's something to be expected. I mean, I don't doubt that, like, the pressure of her job inevitably leads to, like, a very tense, I mean, we don't really know what goes on in government, but I imagine it's very tense behind the scenes. But at the same time, I feel like bullying is a very specific allegation, and if people from within government kind of know what is normal and what isn't normal, what is to be expected and what isn't, then maybe it's worth kind of acknowledging that these allegations might be out of the norm. They might be bullying in a way that isn't kind of normal or expected. Kind of, yeah.
Yeah. I suppose, obviously, if it's a very, you know, high-profile job, but at the same time, it's now come to light that it's in three different government departments that she's most recently worked in. And obviously, if that's kind of a trend, then that is probably worrying. I think something that's kind of worth noting is that a lot of these allegations have come to light after the resignation of the permanent secretary, Sir Philip Rutman. And so I think maybe that obviously encouraged people to kind of come forward and kind of speak out, because obviously, as you know, we've discussed in like several other contexts, it can be like very difficult for people to come and like kind of speak out against people in positions of authority. And what we saw from like a civil servant, because you never kind of see civil servants realistically in the news unless, you know, something goes wrong on their kind of side, but for that kind of public kind of display was obviously showing that he, you know, had enough and also wasn't going to go quietly. And so I think obviously what will be interesting to follow on from here is, like, if this gets to court, what will be the outcome of that, you know? Because if everything gets put out into the open, you know, that will probably be quite damaging for quite a few people, I would have thought.
I think definitely damaging for Boris Johnson and his party. The obviously he's basically wavering on borrowed votes at the moment from a lot of the country, and it's kind of like generally an accepted idea that he needs to really deliver on his promises and needs to make a positive change over the next election cycle. Otherwise, and because if he does, then he could have secured the Conservative Party a majority in years to come. He could really set up, really hammer home the Labour Party home, and while they're still recoiling from the disaster that has been Corbyn and Ed Miliband trying to run for office. So if a few months in to his administration, you've got he's already had a cabinet reshuffle, and if he has to do it again because one of his highest and most trusted officials has been successfully accused of bullying, then that's going to hurt. Yeah. So I think it definitely is in the Conservatives' favour to try and make sure that to look into this and to hopefully be able to prove her innocence, because if they can't, then it, and she's not innocent, mm-hmm. then it's going to be a disaster for a lot of people.
Yeah, and one quick question. Like you said, kind of like electability, do you think that all this kind of thing has cut through with kind of the general public, or do you think people will be more concerned about what kind of the department's doing in relation to, for example, it's like new immigration targets?
I mean, I think people will be like interested in to see how, I think particularly people may be concerned with how robust the government is and kind of how stable the people running the government are, kind of like mainly because also we don't, as ever, like the public don't really know what goes on behind the scenes. So I think it would be a good indication to see how things are running, whether this, whether they're feeling any stress, or whether, you know, Boris is feeling confident with his majority.
Yep, and that's all we've got time for on this section. Of course, just to reiterate, the Home Secretary has obviously denied all these claims against her. We'll be back discussing schools and transport after the song, which is Europa by Jax Jones and Martin Solveig.
I think that you need some more. Wait, holla. Take your body over to the dance floor. Tequila, la, la, la. You need some more. Wait, holla. Take your body over to the dance floor. Tequila, la, la, la.
I'm Ben, still with me are Rebecca and Elliot, and we'll be now going over to Rebecca for a story about the link between poor public transport and places with struggling schools.
So there is a striking overlap between places in England with slow public transport and places with struggling secondary schools, say researchers. Instead of only looking at education data, researchers compared schools using journey times from the Department of Transport. They found clusters of bad transport and underachieving schools in places such as Norfolk and northeast England. Even in richer areas, poor transport seemed to link to lower school results. In reports on academic underachievement, in the same cold spots repeatedly recur, such as left behind towns in the northwest and northeast, declining seaside towns in the south or along the Norfolk coast. The study from education analyst School Dash has examined this pattern, not in terms of exam results or Ofsted grades, but from the perspective of transport connections. Even in places without much deprivation, researcher Tim O'Hanney said more isolated schools are substantially more likely to underperform and less likely to be judged outstanding. Across secondary schools, 31% of those with fast transport links are graded out as outstanding. Among secondary schools in places with slow travel times, 17% are outstanding. Where poor public transport is combined with high levels of deprivation, there is a double whammy, says researchers. Boris Johnson's government has promised to invest in transport as a form of economic regeneration, particularly in the north of England. Anna Vignoles, a professor in education at Cambridge University, highlights a double impact with pupils from communities with low horizons and schools where the cut-off location makes it hard to recruit teachers. So it seems like there are kind of different ideas for this correlation of poor transport and struggling secondary schools. So I wanted to just ask everyone what their thoughts are on this.
Well, I mean, I think it kind of like from a logical perspective makes sense. Going to school, the more difficult it is for parents to get their kids into school, and the more difficult it is, the more hassle it is for a kid to get into school, maybe themselves, you know, catching a long bus in the morning, getting a long bus on the way home, right? They're going to be a bit lethargic getting in and getting out of school at the beginning and end of the day. So it kind of makes sense. It's just a bit, I don't really know how you'd even fix it. I think the best way to fix the problem would be, to do a massive restructure of transport and to sort transport out, which I think is the right perspective. I mean, in the places where these schools are located are typically in constituencies that swung towards the Conservative Party during the election, last election. And so clearly they think, well, you can take an assumption that they would think that what the Conservative Party brought forward in their election regarding this system, you know, regarding a transport revamp, was probably the best way of fixing it out of the parties available. Again, it's not easy just to go, yes, that is or isn't the answer. It's just an assumption you could make. It's just, I think as someone said, staffing is key. It's all about making sure that these bus routes are consistent, reliable, and that's about all you can do, really. I mean, a lot of these places were rural towns and the places that are really out of the way. I mean, what can you do? You can't just build more schools closer to them because it's just like you've got schools that are, that's just a waste of money. And then so you've got some places that will inevitably have to travel half an hour or so to get to the nearest school. I mean, that's just, that's what happens when you have rural communities. There's an element of, we can do what we can to fix it, but with that huge restructure of how we do everything, I think it's be very difficult to change it significantly.
I think I kind of agree with you there. Whilst there kind of is a correlation between the two of them, I don't think obviously that there's a causation between kind of, you know, bad transport and poor school performance, because I mean there probably is obviously something. It's like a lack of investment kind of in both transport and in schools, which obviously have had results in both kind of both areas. Because I mean, where I come from, a lot of people come from, you know, outside in rural areas to get to my school and the schools across my town, but they have quite good bus connectivity, I would thought, especially early in the morning. It's been pretty good for them. And so I never really thought if that kind of linked to kind of like school performance. But I guess it could have perhaps have an impact on kind of people's mindsets, maybe, if they kind of, they basically don't feel like they can be bothered, I mean, to get up and go. So, I mean, maybe that is a link, but I think, like you said, there's kind of a systematic underinvestment in certain areas.
I mean, I do agree that, like, also they mentioned in the article that kind of not being near other jobs that, like, so lots of, if you're in the city, you can obviously see, like, a range of different jobs. If you live in a rural community, chances are, like, farming's kind of the main one that you can physically see. You might see some, like, local jobs, but you're not going to necessarily see the same array that you would in a really big city, and I think that could potentially affect people's attitudes towards education, and maybe like it's not quite like as open-minded to different occupations. But I would also say that, like, I mean, I think it kind of makes I mean, I'm from Norfolk, and a lot of my friends had to travel to school, and there are a lot of really poorly performing schools in Norfolk. It's definitely gotten better, but I would say that there is definitely a direct link between investment, and I think maybe the transport, more so than necessarily people travelling to school, and that, like, I think this is, again, like, correlational rather than causational, but I would say it's a good indication of the lack of investment by the government into the areas, because I think there's really poor investment into schools in the areas, and also transport. So the fact that they're kind of two areas that are struggling, I don't think necessarily has loads in relation to them, because I think, like, the number of people travelling really far isn't necessarily going to be super high, even within Norfolk, but, or, like, again, another area. But I think, yeah, probably the lack of investment is the main reason for the poor school performance and also the poor transport.
Yeah, I think especially we kind of need more investment in stuff like that, especially like buses, because I know when people like talk about transport investment, it all goes on trains, and that's great, because, you know, trains are really good, obviously, where there are trains, but obviously there aren't them across the entire country. They're not everywhere, and a lot of people do rely on buses, and so I think especially they had recent investment in announcement of investment in buses, and I think that will kind of go a long way, but at the same time it's got to kind of go further than it. As with a lot of these things that is coming and promised by this government, you kind of have to go further than what was previously cut, because the same with bus routes, that there were quite a lot of bus routes that have been cut over the last 20 or 30 years, and yes, bringing them back, but also kind of going slightly further, especially if, you know, when we think about the environment as well, you know, making sure everyone gets public transport, and, you know, there's a way to do it.
I do think that also people, like, especially in slightly cut-off areas, people think that it's quite a lot of hassle to try and get new transport, or to try and improve, especially in, like, if you have a small area of, like, a rural area, lots of people, there's not lots of people who are going to be getting the bus, so there doesn't seem to be, like, an economic incentive to connect those areas. But I think for, like, if you're traveling as, like, a child trying to get the bus, you don't want to have to wait an hour for the next one. Like, I think there could be potentially investment needs to be perhaps had by the government to kind of perhaps subsidize areas that otherwise might be kind of missed as, like, an economic opportunity for the actual bus companies. But I mean, I would say that, like, also if there was more investment in the actual areas themselves, people might not need to travel so far, because I think a lot of the time when you get kind of cities, you get a lot of rural areas outside of the cities, and then people are having to travel to the cities, because, like, I know that a lot of my friends didn't go to, like, their local school because it would either be full or because it was really badly invested in, like, it was a really bad school, so they'd have to get a train and then go into the city and stuff. So I feel like if you invest more in those rural areas, that could help the whole thing.
Yeah, I guess if you want to kind of find a good school, people will really put the effort in sometimes, I think. So that's all we've got time for on that subject, but stay tuned, because after the song, we'll be back discussing the US election and the winners and losers from the Super Tuesday primaries. So coming up next, it's Dream Factory, which is by Frankie Stew and Harvey Gunn, featuring Loyal Khanna. Stay tuned.
I don't know why, I can see things but I can't show why. I don't wanna do it when it comes to showtime. Said I would stop, I can't, I'm so high. I do the things I want to do. It could have been you. It could have been you. It could have been you. Know the reason I can over deep, not supposed to be this. Write my feelings and show my secrets. I got things in my head but aren't know the feeling. Hold my thoughts and I know I'm breathing less. Everything I've seen so far has been a test. I won't look back so I still can't regret. Jay-Z's misses to the left, to the left. There's but things that I still can't forget. And when I get older, I wanna be the best. I have mad dreams where I fall out my bed. I guess that I learned from the things that you said. It's weird that I earned from the things in my head. I think that we go somewhere in the end. I hope that I go somewhere when it ends. Get me? I don't know the way. I can see things but I can't show why. I don't wanna do it when it comes to showtime. Said I would stop playing, can't, I'm so high. I do the things I want to do. It could have been you. It could have been you. It could have been you. I think that all the things that you've done, I've done. When I make decisions, I don't make the right one. I wanna know the angle I live my life from. Right angle or the wrong one that I decide on. Don't wanna beat myself up, I need help up. When people think they're helping, I feel held up. Yeah, it's hard, but I can change. Turn my phone light off, cause you like the way. Guess what I'm trying to say is this. I write down my goals and I put them in a list. If I don't reach my goal, then I do get pissed. I shouldn't do. Maybe that's the thing I should switch on. Overdrive, but I don't drive. Can't live in the past, I don't think that I owe you. Hope one day I could show you. Even if you think I don't know you.
It could have been, it should have been. If you'd have worked harder then it would have been. I know the hood has been good to a couple men. Trying to make a couple grand, like I couldn't sin. I don't remember when I couldn't swim. I had my eyes on the deep when they pushed me in. I've been trying to stay afloat on this crooked whim. They lie, I'm on the outside looking in. But no one's looking out, and they be filling me with doubt. Trying to keep the spirit in my mother's house. Trust, the pressure's always in my mouth. I write the words down, but yo, I can't say them loud. So am I lying, am I bluffing now? Is it enough to simply make your mother proud? I mix Sanjay free foul, what they say is foul. Probably just another verse, never coming out.
I can see things, but I can't show why. I don't wanna do it when it comes to showtime. Said I would stop, but I can't, I'm so high. I do the things I want to do. It could have been you. It could have been you.
It should have been.
It could have been you.
It would have been.
To the Pulse. I'm Ben, still with me. We have Rebecca and Elliot. And of course, if you want to contact us, all you have to do is go to URN Pulse on Twitter or go to our website, URN1350, and send us a message. So far, we've been discussing Priti Patel and then the provision of transport and school quality. But now we'll be moving on to our international story for today, which is about the US Super Tuesday elections, which are for the Democratic and Republican presidential primaries. And this has been the comeback of Joe Biden, who has won 9 of the 14 states that voted to pick a Democratic White House candidate on Super Tuesday, which is a remarkable rebound for his campaign. So the former US Vice President overturned predictions and narrowly took the key state of Texas, beating his main challenger, Bernie Sanders. However, Mr. Sanders is still projected to win in the state of California, the biggest prize of the night, because it has the most delegates, as well as in 3 other states. Those two candidates are in the lead in the race to face Republican Donald Trump at the election in November. Former Mayor Michael Bloomberg spent more than $500 million, which is $500 million, sorry, which is £390 million of his own money on the campaign, but did not win a single state. He's since dropped out this afternoon. And Senator Elizabeth Warren, who was once one of the front runners, suffered a humiliating defeat to Mr. Biden in her home state of Massachusetts. So the Super Tuesday awarded more than 1,300 of the 1,991 delegates needed to clinch the Democratic White House nomination in July. As things stand, Mr. Biden has 400, Mr. Sanders just over 300, and this does include only partial results from California, which has 415 delegates just in itself. So a quick overview of how important this is. Only last month, Joe Biden's campaign was all but written off by some observers after he finished in a poor fourth place in the Iowa caucuses and fifth in New Hampshire. But on Tuesday, Mr. Biden won Texas, the second biggest state, along with Massachusetts, Minnesota, Oklahoma, Arkansas, Alabama, Tennessee, North Carolina, and Virginia. He's also projected to win Maine as well. So that's just an overview of what has been going on within the last 24 hours, because in US politics, it has been a very, a lot has changed in the last week or so, if you follow US politics. So do you think that this is a significant moment? Do you think that Bernie Sanders and the left of the US Democrats still have a chance? Is Donald Trump going to win again? And also, can we kind of take anything from the UK to kind of predict what might be going on?
I don't know. Well, Sanders is predicted to take California, which is obviously the big prize of the Super Tuesday. And despite the fact that Biden has done really well, I don't think it's early enough to call. I think it's too early, sorry, to call who will actually take the full election. But looking at it, I'd say I honestly think that Donald Trump's got this in the bag. I mean, his approval rating is actually quite high in America. And definitely enough to secure him the election win. Comparison to Sanders, who represents a political movement too far to the left for most of America. Maybe California, because California's his own little, you know, hippie paradise. But outside of there, it's too far left for America to go, even for a Democrat. And Biden just represents represents Obama 2.0. And Hillary Clinton represented a little bit of a change from Obama, but not a lot. And she got voted out based on, first of all, the fact that it's Hillary Clinton and no one likes Hillary Clinton. And two, the fact that people just wanted a change. People didn't want more of the same stuff. The same people were suffering again and again under a Democrat lead. And I think that that's kind of fed into the fact that, again, Donald Trump is too popular at the moment, and the people who's running against, there's no one who's popular enough to stop him. Bernie Sanders will win really heavily in some places, but lose entirely in others. And when you're looking at some of the swing states, I don't think that they will that they can afford something similar to an extremist view. I want to say extremist, I mean, compare it to the UK, right? Corbyn was typically seen as quite an extremist lefty in the UK, right? And so time and time again, he was in a lot of the marginal seats. He just wasn't electable based on the fact that people weren't happy to support someone who was that extreme in either way, left or right. And the fact that he was so far left saw him lose catastrophically this year, or sorry, last year, and the election before that. If it wasn't for the fact that, you know, Theresa May did basically nothing for the entire election, he probably would have had just as bad of a defeat. So that's kind of like moving into what you said about what can we take from the UK. From the UK, I would probably compare Bernie Sanders to Jeremy Corbyn in this situation. It's the same thing. I think Trump is similar to Boris Johnson. The fact that they're both a bit like Marmite, you either love them or you hate them, but enough people don't want to see Sanders in to the point where they're going to happy with another, with more Trump. Because, and then people both voted in Boris because the fact that he represented actually finally leaving the European Union, which they wanted, and it really shift towards this element of nationalism and self-independence, which is kind of what Trump has done for America. And again, we see his approval ratings have only risen since he got into office. So I think it's a secure win for Trump, regardless of who gets the Democrat vote.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think that the Republicans do have quite a strong chance of winning the election. I don't know how, I think it's a bit difficult to say that, like, even if the Republicans did win, how much they'd win by. I agree that I think Sanders is a bit too controversial as, I mean, he is quite extreme as a left voter, which you would think you would kind of need to counteract a lot of kind of Trump's support. You know, I think a lot of the time whenever you get like a strong conservative, you get a strong left side as well, because it's quite a polarizing kind of political scene. But I think Biden potentially has a better chance than Sanders in that sense. But again, I don't know whether it's going to make much difference whether or not Biden or Sanders get much in the way of support, because I do feel like the Republicans are doing quite well in terms of support.
Yeah. Just an interesting other thing to pick up on is kind of the campaign of Michael Bloomberg, who is a former mayor of New York City, who kind of staked his entire campaign on kind of doing well yesterday, but didn't win a single state, but came first in the territory of American Samoa, which only has 56,000 people who live on it. So kind of given the fact that he's a like a multi-billionaire and spent $500 million of his own money on his campaign, and for that to kind of come up with nothing in the end of it. So like, what do you guys think of kind of money in politics, and whether people should just be able to, you know, run if they have the money for it? Because surely that's kind of quite exclusionary of people who, you know, who are more reliant on, you know, other people in order to kind of run for president and other political offices. And like, I guess if you have the money, you just say, yeah, I could do a okay job of this. I think it's one of the reasons why Trump ran in the first place, is because it was, yeah, I could do it and I've got the money, so I'll go for it. What do you think of kind of like money in politics and stuff like that?
It's very American. Like, it's very much plays into the American mindset of kind of rugged individualism, pulling yourself up by your bootstraps, and very much relying on your own kind of funding. I think a lot of Americans would see it as kind of a justification if you've made kind of a slightly unusual amount of money, almost suspicious amount of money, then you kind of can justify putting yourself up for presidency because you've earned it through hard work or what. I mean, quite clearly, Trump didn't exactly earn a lot, most of his money through hard work. He earned it through his dad. But nonetheless, like, the principle is still, I think, the same, is that a lot of Americans don't really question a lot of wealth, so they would just see, well, that's like a fair play. If you can, I think it's quite difficult to also stop people from doing that if they do have the money to kind of afford themselves to campaign for themselves. Yes, of course, that's going to be an advantage, even if you don't directly use that money.
But I think one way that some people look at it is the fact that if you have the money, right, then you're in the economy, at least wise, you are probably already a pretty influential figure. You know, if you've got the influence, then having an office that is purely about influences, it shows some level of, you know, qualification in some regard. And another way that if you don't have the money, then you go for donations and you get sponsorships, which if you can secure those, shows you're a charismatic person who people can follow behind and be led by. So I mean, that's one way that some people look at the idea that, you know, you either self-fund it yourself, in which case you're, you know, it's a rugged individualism, you've done everything yourself, you're proper you're an influential entrepreneur, or, you know, however you make your money. And if you don't and you require the funding, then at least if you secure it, then you're a people's person, which obviously is quite good for an election.
I just wanted to actually say something in relation to like history of American elections. There has been one particular well-known historical occasion with McKinley where he, ironically, you could say, was against somebody who was the people's person, but it kind of didn't matter because he managed, his opponent, whilst popular among kind of the Populist Party, which is a very much a people's movement, he wasn't able to secure his position, mainly due to a lot of McKinley's tactics, which he was a very rich man. He was able to use a lot of funding to basically smear the opponent's name and therefore didn't win. So I think it does matter in the sense of, like, I think you can have perhaps an advantage. But I mean, I think it's a difficult thing to stop.
Yeah, and obviously it kind of shows that in some cases, like we saw yesterday, that money can't always buy you love in terms of these kind of these elections, and obviously we'll see how this plays out, because obviously this has still got a long way to go. It is only the 4th of March, but the whole process continues on until July, and then of course after that it's the US kind of general election where everything gets going as a whole, and we'll be keep on going until the 3rd of November, so probably we'll be discussing this a lot more as we keep going through this process. So that's all we've got time for on this topic. We'll be back afterwards to discuss gender reassignment and how one patient is taking on the NHS clinic over and says that they should have stopped her from undergoing transitioning. So this is Glass Animals, Your Love. Now for our final story of today's show, we're going over to Elliot.
So a 23-year-old woman who is taking legal action against the NHS, or against an NHS gender clinic, says that she should have been challenged more by medical staff over her decision to transition to a male as a teenager. A judge gave the go-ahead for a full hearing of the case against the Tavistock and Portman NHS Trust. So the woman was, I think she said she was 15 at the time, and went in to get a gender reassignment, transitioning from female to male. And she is now being said that she's now trying to claim against the NHS clinic by saying that they basically just gave her the go-ahead and didn't think that, you know, well, maybe because of the fact that I'm underage, I don't have the... that, you know, I was underage, you know, I wasn't formed enough to make a decision, and you just kind of let me do it. And she was referred at the age of 16 and said that the fact she was below 18 showed that they were just it was unfair, because they, as a child, she wasn't informed, and the NHS clinic should have made more of an impact into stopping her. So first of all, like, a question I'd like to basically pose is, do you think that, who do you think's in the right here, the clinic or the woman in terms of this case? And do you think it's fair for the woman to basically to make this claim against the clinic? Were the clinic okay to give her the go-ahead, or should they have actually fought more and told her to stop?
I think it's quite a difficult issue. I wasn't quite aware that you could get hormone drugs quite this easily. From all my understanding and people I know who have transitioned, it wasn't this simple at all. Like, it took I thought the standard was like 4 years you had to agree. I mean, admittedly, I don't know what point they kind of started, like, they asked or anything, and so it's entirely possible that you can transition, well, obviously she did, under the age of 18. I think it's kind of a difficult one. I understand, like, the concerns on both sides. I think a lot of people who are transgender have to wait a very, very long time before they can get some, like, hormone blockers, or they can transition in the way that they want to. And I think that can have, like, a really strong mental effect on their mental health. But at the same time, I do understand the issue that, you know, if you decide something when you're a child or under 18, there's a certain level of irresponsibility there. Like, you don't necessarily understand what you are deciding to do, and also, like, a period of time to actually think about it.
Yeah, I guess in terms of, like, maturity, is there's kind of, like, no fine line. I guess, like, the law has this kind of, like, legal definition of that you become an adult when you turn 18. And so, obviously, anything you do when you're under 18 is, you know, you're as a child. And, you know, there is a fair point to be made there. It's so obviously, a difficult subject of, like, where you kind of, like, draw the line on these kind of things. I don't know whether kind of, like, bringing a case kind of saying you should have kind of done more to stop me. I think it's an interesting one. I don't know whether or not it will be successful, because I guess there is kind of an area of responsibility here. But at the same time, if you kind of make the decision because you kind of, like, feel it's truly right, then, you know, obviously that's a decision for you to make yourself. And then if you kind of regret it, I don't think, you know, always being a child can kind of be, like, the answer to that.
I feel like it is also, like, quite an, like, the age thing can be kind of arbitrary. I think from the age of 12, you're allowed to pick anything, like, medical. So, like, in other words, like, you are considered to have, like, a level of comprehension to, like, decide whether, like, for instance, if you're having an operation and you were over at the age of 12, I think they have to ask you rather than your parents. So you can't, like, be forced to have an operation you don't want. Which I think would be interesting in this case, because obviously this is a medical procedure that she chose when she was 16, so still under the age, but still over an age where you're kind of allowed to do that. I think maybe this would it's kind of interesting from an individual case, because I think a lot of the time you do hear about like people saying, oh, well, you don't want people to transition and then like regret it, especially if they're like a child. But you don't often hear about cases. So I think maybe what's interesting is that because she's come forward, maybe this will... I mean, on the one hand, you do worry that this will kind of just fuel transphobia, like people will use it as a way to kind of fuel transphobia. But at the same time, it is a legitimate concern that maybe people need to look over laws and like actually look at this properly, because I do feel like it's not really tackled well by the laws or the government at all.
I think, especially with that, I think there is kind of a, you know, I think you're right. I think the way kind of like she says it, it's like I was allowed to run with the idea almost like a fantasy. I think that kind of, for some people, obviously, that's obviously her case, but I guess for some people, it can obviously be a real struggle kind of coming to terms with their, you know, identity. And then that is, you know, I think we have been accused in the past as kind of a society of not being accepted of kind of people's identity and who they kind of truly believe that they actually are. And so kind of, if, you know, she said that she wanted to do this, then obviously it's their kind of thing to, you know, it's their kind of job to give advice, I guess. And obviously that, you know, there you can make the case that you need to kind of do everything to stress, like, the arguments on both sides and talk about the risks. But at the same time, if you kind of believe that is what you want to be, it can be, like, very difficult to stop you, I guess. And, you know, it's all right, you know, afterwards claiming, you know, saying that you kind of want to go back, but you can't dismiss your own role in kind of the thing that happened.
I think that there has been a problem in the past. It obviously, this was about 7 years ago now, and obviously our general societal views toward this thing was very new. It was very nuanced. It only really had been an acceptable sort of like idea for a few years. And so being quite new, it was kind of like, we have this societal shock, don't we, where when people go in at the age of 16 and say, I want a gender reassignment, you don't want... I think maybe the gender client was kind of like maybe scared of the fact that you... If they say no, we're not allowing you to. We're going to try and tell you you're wrong and advise you against it. They could have been accused of being, you know, anti-progressive and quite I think the word like bigoted, like just basically intolerant towards that sort of view. I mean, we've seen this in the past with There was the police station, the police area that was basically that ignored things, certain cases, because of the fact that they were worried about being deemed as anti-progressive, because it was people of certain race doing. Obviously, I'm not equating the two because they're very different issues, but there's an element to consider is that maybe there was a fact of the gender clinic, maybe they didn't put in as much effort and force as they should have. A bit of common sense, you'd say you're underage, you're under the age of 18, maybe this is a life-changing thing, maybe we should think a bit more about it, due to the fact that they were worried about what their social implication would be and affecting their trust, which I think is completely viable.
I think it's also quite an individual thing, because I think, yeah, I mean, I think it's a valid point, but I think the difficulties is sometimes people might perceive it as like undermining what they're going to say. People have been on like a journey for a different amount of time. Some people are like when they're very young and some people when they're older. So I think it is kind of difficult. It's quite an individual thing to go through.
Yeah. And we'll see obviously how this court case ends up, because it has a judge's ruled that they can proceed. So that's all we've got time for this evening. Thank you for listening today. Thank you to Rebecca and Elliot for joining me. Just a reminder that The Pulse is on every weekday between 5 and 6. So listen in and we'll bring you some more news that matters to you. And we'll be back tomorrow with a Mental Health Day special. And so make sure you tune in for that, because that's definitely going to be interesting. So we'll leave you with this song. It's Desolée.